Hello, everybody, and welcome to the GMS Magazine YouTube channel. This is the RPG Interview Room, the show in which I am lucky enough to get together with people from the world of role-playing games and talk with them about, well, their jobs and whatever it is they're doing. This is, I'm afraid, being recorded during the coronavirus pandemic, and thus I am at home. I'm not at the studio. And therefore, the quality production is not exactly the same, but hopefully you will enjoy it nevertheless. Today I have with me somebody who's been at the helm of Belgrain Press for a number of years now, and has been doing some absolutely amazing, amazing work and helping Belgrain become consolidated as one of the top leading RPG publishers in the world. I'm talking about Kat Tobing, who, you know, just in her first year of being an editor for Belgrain Press so many years ago now, she managed to publish like 12 books in one single year. But what's behind Belgrain? What's behind the company that hires giants like Robin D. Laws and Ken Haidt and Rob Hainsu to create some of the most iconic games out there? Well, I'm going to ask her that and a lot more things that hopefully you will find interesting. Thank you very much for being there. Please stay safe at this time. Be kind to one another. And I will talk to you very, very soon. Kat, welcome to the show. I reluctantly will say welcome back because we've been talking before this. I can't remember if you'd be here or not.
Yeah, I have no idea. It feels like I should have been, and I would be very surprised if I hadn't been, but if you asked me when I had been, I would just not be able to tell you. I have no idea.
Me neither.
So it's been too long. It's been too long anyways, but we can definitely say.
I'm going to give a positive spin to this and say this is testament to the insane amount of time that we've both been in this industry and known each other. That it has disappeared from our memories. But however, that also means that I cannot remember how good you are actually answering questions. So, yes, exactly. I need to put you to the test first. Okay. So I can, I know that.
I'm ready.
Good. So I'm going to ask you five things. Okay. Question number one.
Okay.
Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Okay, good. Good. That didn't take you long. That was an easy one.
Yeah, my Skype handle has coffee in the title, as does my email. It's okay. That was an easy one. Right. I'm not expecting them all to be that easy, but that one, I was right there with that. Yeah.
They're not complicated. Okay. The beach or the mountain?
Beach.
Okay, that was an easy one too. Good. Mm-hmm. Good.
Yep.
Cars or motorbikes?
Okay. I knew they were not going to be all that easy. I don't know. I have had some bad experiences with motorbikes, like falling off them and crashing them into things. So on the grounds that I have not yet fallen out of a car or crashed a car into things, although that is coming, I'm learning to drive at the moment. I'm going to go with a car.
Okay, that's a perfectly legitimate answer.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
Question number four. Fantasy or science fiction?
Science fiction.
Wow, I thought that was going to be harder. Yeah. That wasn't hard at all.
Nope. It's been sci-fi for me since I was a kid, the whole way. My dad is a really big sci-fi fan, and so he originally kind of got me into, I would steal his books because I was a voracious reader when I was a kid. And so I was only allowed to take out 3 books per week from the library. And we didn't have a bookshop in my hometown because it was really tiny. So I would like steal my dad's books. So I got into sci-fi super early and it stopped.
Wait a second, let me stop you there. You were allowed 3 books a week and yet you still had to take your dad's books? How many books a week did you read?
Lots and lots. Like I would start reading as soon as we left the library. I'd be a quarter of a way through a book by the time I got home in the car. These are kids' books though, you know, they're not, there's nothing in them. So yeah, but I was a really, really big reader.
So you have superpowers. Okay, that's clear now. Good.
No, I'm a very slow reader as well. My best friend is actually a speed reader and she's just ridiculous. Like she can just flick through a book like that and just be done with it.
I cannot do that. Dyslexia is an anti-superpower. So it sucks. Yeah. Anyway, fifth question. Zombies or vampires?
Oh, vampires. Okay. Yeah. Good. That was also very easy. I like vampires.
You know, they win in this series. I've been asking everybody exactly the same questions, and everybody agrees that vampires are way better than zombies. I think they're more versatile.
They are. There's a lot more you can do with them, whereas with zombies, you can make them fast or make them slow, and that's kind of it. Exactly. I mean, I guess they can eat brains or not eat brains, but, like, yeah, I think they're a bit limited.
Yeah, true. Okay, fine. Now we're going to go into the serious topic, because you are one of the top women in the industry. It's the truth.
That's a question, I'm going to say no is the answer.
Oh, no, that was not a question. That was a statement.
We were talking about this before
we started the interview. You know, three of the largest companies or the most important companies in role-playing games are actually led by women. And that is something that seems to completely go over an awful lot of people.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't understand it. I was doing an interview with somebody, and we were kind of talking about similar things, and we were talking about my position at Pelgrane, and he said to me, "Oh my gosh, you know, it's amazing. I can't believe, like, it's a company that's run by a woman." And I was like, that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And I just, off the top of my head, I made a list of 20 women running RPG companies. And then I started doing a bit of research and I got up to 50. So there are an awful lot of RPG companies that are, and that's before you get into board games as well, which is equally, if not more, representative. There are a lot of women doing a lot of the serious heavy lifting behind companies in the industry. Yeah, and as to why people don't know that, I think there is a really big tendency, I think, as well in the industry to really kind of glamorize, like, the writers and the artists and the creatives, because it's very easy to see what they do. You know, mm-hmm. If you're reading, like, Ken or Robin's words, you know, if you're looking at Jerome's art, you know, you can see their output, whereas you can't really see what I have done in Pelgrane or what I do. My work is a lot more invisible, I guess. And I think that certainly for women like me who are more on the production side or more on the business side or the administrative side, that work can very often be invisible. And that goes double for when it's work largely being done by women as well. And that's just kind of true of the world as it is at the moment. Anything that a lot of women are doing is not valued as highly as work that a lot of men are doing. So
is it disheartening for you to think about that sort of thing, or is it something that actually motivates you to say, you know, screw you people who don't know me, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna be amazing at it?
Well, I mean, and this is the, so it, for me personally, it's been a really big challenge actually, because I'm most comfortable when I'm kind of the person getting all the stuff done in the background, and there's somebody else out there being the big rock star and being the face. So this is a kind of a big departure for me, but equally it's really important for me to do things like this, you know, with you, to do interviews, to do panels at conventions, to be kind of publicly seen as being involved in Pelgrane, and the extent to which I'm involved with Pelgrane being kind of demonstrated effectively in the public sphere as well. So it's not that, you know, it's not that I'm like, no, screw you guys, I'm going to be everywhere. And it's not that, you know, it is more of a kind of, I guess I feel like I have a responsibility to be visible, right? A responsibility to be, you know, there's that phrase, if you can see it, you can be it. And I want to show other women that there are women in the industry doing this work behind the scenes. So that is my main driver, more so than anything else, is kind of being visible and being out there and being accessible to other women who are maybe considering doing something similar and are looking for, looking for support or kind of looking for advice on how to do that.
Now, Belgrane, admittedly, has always been a very inclusive company. Simon Rogers has always been very keen to make sure that there is as much diversity, there is as much inclusivity within the company itself. Even though one would think, you know, that your top writers are all men, but from behind, Simon's always made an effort to make sure, you know, that Beth was there before you. You arrived at the company as an editor. And I know that because I remember Simon telling me this at the time, you know, she's put 12 books out this year, which is an absolutely insane amount of work.
Yeah.
So do you think that that's made it slightly easier for you than other women would have it in different companies?
Yeah. I mean, I always think like I've really, really landed on my feet with Belgrane. Like you said, Simon, it's, you know, trying to make the world a better place is such a priority for Simon as well. Trying to increase kind of representation, make sure that we're working with diverse people when and where we can. All of that kind of thing is really important to Simon. And it's also really important to the rest of the company as well. You know, it's not something that we're doing kind of by ourselves. It's like the whole team are in support of that. And just the team in general at Belgrane as well as Simon, you know, like they're just really great people as well. And all of our customers as well, which is the most important thing really, because there's no point in us, you know, there's no point in us trying to do particular things or trying to do things in a certain way if our customers aren't kind of there with us and they're supporting all of our efforts, you know, all of the work that we try and do. You know, they see it and they support it and they literally enable us to continue to do it with their dollars, you know. So yeah, so we're very, very lucky at Belgrane. I think not everyone, I know that not everyone has had it so easy. And, you know, for a while I was like the only woman at Belgrane, and that was, you know, again, it's a different dynamic, I think, when there is a woman there and the way that people speak to each other and interact with each other and ways of working are sometimes different. So in that respect, it can be challenging, I think, to go into any male dominated company. But like I said, I've been super, super lucky with the Belgranistas. They're really great to work with.
And yet, I mean, okay, all the credit due to Simon, but I don't want this to feel like Simon is being, you know, the white knight in their shining armor sort of thing, because
white man saves the world. Yay.
Exactly. But that is actually not the case, because you started as an editor and you've ended up as the co-owner of the company, which is not the kind of promotion one gets easily in any job.
It's not.
So what is it that you brought to the company that actually helped you and enabled you to get to that point?
Yeah, well, I think you kind of touched on it earlier, basically. In my interview, because I come out of finance, I come out of accounting. That's my background. And that's what I was doing before I started working at Belgrane. And when Simon was interviewing me for the job, one of the things he said to me was, look, you know, there's a really big discrepancy here between the skill set that you need to do a publishing job and your current skill set. You know, how are you going to bridge that gap? And in my interview, I said, look, I'll work 70 or 80 hour weeks and I will just train myself on the job to do all the things that I need to do. And that was what I did. And like you said, like my first year, I was told to put out 12 books. And so I put out 12 books and I nearly killed myself. It was just too much. But I learned a lot by doing it. And as a result, I'm now, you know, I can now kind of manage people working in all aspects of the business. You know, I can do a bit of InDesign, I can do a bit of Photoshop, I can do a bit of editing, I can do a bit of, you know, kind of game development, game design things, you know. So there's really, you know, there's no aspect of the business now that I can't kind of have a go at. And I think that was the kind of key thing really, is that, like, as well as being very much a jack of all trades, I was always, I'm, this was my dream job. You know, this is like literally, like, this is the job that I've wanted for the last 20 years. And I didn't realize that this job could exist. And again, working with such an incredible team of people, working on such amazing products as well that I really enjoy, like, I was literally willing to just do whatever it took to be the person that the company needed me to be. And so I did, and I put a lot of effort into it. And I'm also, have I lost you?
No, I'm here.
Okay, great. Cool. You got suddenly all pixelated. But yeah, so I think that was kind of the key thing really, was that I was also willing to take on more responsibilities. So I have a lot of what they call initiative in job descriptions. I like arguably too much initiative, but if I see a thing that needs to be done, I'll just kind of go and do it. And if I don't know how to do it, I'll teach myself how to do it, and then I'll do it. So I'm very much a kind of an evolving kind of, well, I like to think that I'm an evolving employee. So yeah, so I think it was kind of all of that. That meant that I went very quickly from being somebody who was an employee of the company to being somebody who was really, really, really quite necessary to the continued running of the company at the level that it had kind of grown to at that point. And that was, you know, and that was kind of it. It was like, you know, Simon basically said, you know, I'm concerned now that somebody's going to come in and poach you. You know, that like some other company is going to come along and like make you an offer or something and steal you away. And so what would it take for you to stay? And I was like, oh, well, you know, you'd have to give me half the company.
okay.
Joking. Like, you know, just, you know, like, and he did. And he claims, and I don't know that this is true, but his memory is much better than mine. But he claims that in my interview, he asked me that, you know, where do you want to be in 5 years question. And I said, running your company. So he claims that it was all foreshadowed and everything, that was what I had said I was going to do. So I don't know. But yeah, so that was a very long and rambling kind of how we got to where we are kind of response.
So you didn't know anything about the RPG industry itself before you started working, or were you familiar with the ins and outs of the RPG, not the community but the industry?
So that's a really good question. I think it depends on what you mean by the industry.
Okay.
So when I started at Pelgrane, when I got that job, I had run 4 different conventions in 2 different countries, well, 3 okay. different countries. I had founded a convention that is still going like 20 years later. I had also done a lot of volunteer work for other companies. So I used to be a company called Contested Ground Studios made a game called A-State. Mm-hmm. And they were based in Edinburgh, where I was based for a long time. And I worked quite closely with them. I was kind of doing a bit of accounting for them and doing a bit of stock management, that kind of thing. So I was kind of going to all of their team meetings and that kind of thing. So to the extent that I had already been involved with the, even though I wasn't involved in the running of it, I had been part of a team that was, you know, running a very small RPG company, but still running an RPG company. So that was kind of, you know, does that count as industry experience? It, you know, it's tough to know. I think, yeah.
Okay. Like, well, the reason I asked you that is because I wanted to ask you, was it being in the inside, you know, as in publishing the books and getting to the point of owning the company, was it what you would expect it was going to be?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, very much so. Because I, you know, like I was saying before, when I saw the job description for the role that I originally interviewed for, I kind of read through it and I was like, this is my dream job. And, it, you know, I was totally right on that. It's, I have a very short attention span and I get bored easily. So just being able to like move between very different types of work in my working day is really important to me. I work remotely from my hometown, which is fantastic. That's been really freeing for me as well. You know, it's got a lot of, all of the kind of the positives that I expected to be there are there. So it is very much how I expected it to be. Like, it wasn't kind of a surprise to me, I think.
Looking at Pelgrane from the moment you started and looking at the company now, mm-hmm. How far down is it from being where you wanted it to be?
Wow. I mean, it's, you know, it's a very... I like to kind of set goals for it every year, you know, as kind of a, from a strategic perspective, to kind of say this year we'll try and focus on doing these things. I would have to say it's pretty much where I would want it to be. You know, I'm really comfortable with where it is right now, and it might be nice to grow it a bit more, but I don't like, I'm very conscious that it's, if we were to suddenly overnight, you know, develop a D&D or a Pathfinder, you know, if we were to suddenly explode to that size, I just don't think we would be able to, I don't think we'd be the same company at all. So I really like where we are now. I think it's a really good place because we're small enough that we know all our customers. You know, we know the people who are buying kind of our games. We're able to hang out at kind of conventions and talk to them. And, you know, we're very involved. Like, we're very, very involved in the company and everything the company does. And I feel like if we grew much more, we would lose that. You know, like, we have an admin assistant now called Becky Smith, and she's working on customer support. So she's doing all of our customer support emails and things. And even that, I'm like, that makes me, you know, she's doing a really great job, but it makes me a bit sad that there's that kind of level of distance suddenly. Yeah. Between me and customers. And I just think if we grew much more than where we are, that distance would just continue to increase. And for me, and I know this is true for like the rest of the team as well, like we love hearing about people playing our games. We love that. Absolutely love it. And it would just be really sad to lose that, you know, to be so busy doing work, you know, doing like actual, you know, the behind the scenes work of things, that we weren't able to be out there talking to people about our games, you know. So So I'm super, the only thing, my only kind of thing that I had hoped I would have sorted out by this point is our website. I really want to upgrade our website, and we're working on it at the moment, but it's, yeah, that's the only thing I kind of, if you had said to me when I started, well, what's going to be the first thing you do? I would have said, yeah, I'm going to fix the website.
Okay. Well, this is never too late. how... being a company that's been very keen on not just inclusivity, which you have, but also safety, what have been the challenges that you have faced, you know, in terms of deciding, no, the stance the company is going to take is this, and we are not going to barge on these issues of safety and inclusivity?
Yeah, so we've had, you know, again, I've had a number of kind of experiences at different conventions down through the years. And I, for me, a key thing that I try and remind myself all the time is that I'm an employee. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds weird, but what I mean by that is that I shouldn't have a different standard for myself than I would have for people that I employ. And I had a really unpleasant incident at a convention in the UK, and I felt like I was on my own on the booth at the time, and I was really kind of, you know, it really made me think, gosh, there was nothing, you know, there was nothing at all that I could have done there, and the convention had nothing in place to protect me or anyone in that situation. And so for me, I was like, I wouldn't have brought an employee to that convention again for that reason, that I felt like the convention was not doing enough to ensure my employees' safety. And I was like, well, it shouldn't be a different thing for my employees as to what it is for me. You know, that should also be true for me. So Simon and I had a big conversation about it. And eventually we kind of said, look, as a company, we're not comfortable with kind of officially bringing our, you know, our team and whatever size that is. It depends on, you know, the convention as to who's all there. We're not comfortable attending a convention in a professional capacity, as in like having a booth there, if the convention doesn't have a publicly posted anti-harassment policy, if they don't have something in place that acknowledges that, you know, kind of harassment based on sex, based on gender presentation, based on race, you know, that all of these things are justifications that people use to harass people. And without something that explicitly condemns that kind of behavior and states out quite clearly the actions that the convention and the convention staff will take in the event that something like that happens, we're just not comfortable being there. So that was kind of, you know, we posted something on our website about it. And since then, every convention that has either approached us for sponsorship or for support, or conventions that we've been considering having a booth at, we're only supporting conventions that have publicly posted anti-harassment policies. And when we first started doing that, I think it was maybe 2015, I think we first kind of decided to draw that line and make what had been a kind of a vague thought that we had our official policy on it. Like at that point, anti-harassment policies were just starting to come in. So the bigger conventions had them, but some of the smaller ones didn't. And we've really seen a massive evolution over time towards having an anti-harassment policy as more and more organizations realize that it's just a fundamental part of, you know, it's a necessity when you're running a large event that you have to ensure that you're protecting your delegates. You know, you have to be, you know, you have to explicitly state that you are the kind of convention that does not want people to be harassed at it, and that you will do something about it in the event that there is some kind of incident. So it was really challenging. Certainly for a long time, we weren't able to attend UK Games Expo. We had a lot of conversations with Games Expo about the anti-harassment policy, and we ended up having agreed to disagree on it because they steadfastly refused to implement one because they felt that it wasn't necessary. So we're very, very glad to see that they've now reconsidered that. As of last year, they had a publicly posted anti-harassment policy and a full kind of policy that the staff were backing up in the event of an incident. And as it happened, you might have heard there was an incident at Games Expo, and the staff reacted very quickly to that. They knew what they were doing. And yeah, I mean, that's kind of it. That's what you're looking for, really, I think, in a convention. So yeah, so it's really, I feel like, you know, really things have changed a lot, even in just that 5 years or whatever. And it's become much easier for us now. I mean, now it's very rare for us now to be contacted by a convention or to consider going to a convention that doesn't have an anti-harassment policy, which is fantastic.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, I remember having that kind of conversations with the organizers of the UK Games Expo at the time when they were, you know, the law of the land, that was the kind of go-to phrase, the law of the land is there and it already stops that, which is a bit, it doesn't.
The law of the land does not in any way protect minorities.
No. Even to be honest, even majorities, if you don't want to be photographed, then that has to be specified. There isn't anything, you know, in a private place that says you cannot take a photograph of people. You have to specify that thing. You have to specify if somebody says, go away that you must go away, that if people are having a conversation, don't interrupt repeatedly, that sort of thing. And unfortunately, people need to be told that, that sort of thing, which is...
I read something recently that I really liked. It was the biggest problem with common sense is that it's not common enough.
True. Or sensical, for that matter. So you have, I think it's fair to say that you as a company, you spearheaded the movement to actually implement an awful lot of anti-harassment policies and code of conducts, because I believe that 2015 was also the first year that Dragon Meat had an official code of conduct. And I remember the stupid attempt backlash that had, and didn't really last long at all, thank goodness. But let's face it, an awful lot of conventions started because you said, no, we want this. How has that translated to the US? Have you seen a parallel increase, or have you seen still companies and conventions that still say, no, we don't need this?
I think we have seen a kind of a parallel in the US. I think to a large extent, the US are often, it's interesting to me the ways in which we're each more progressive than the other. So the US is definitely a lot more progressive than us in Europe in terms of social justice, in terms of kind of having those conversations, driving those conversations. There's a lot of good work being done in Europe with them as well. But I think that in that respect, it's been my experience that we're often kind of behind them in terms of the implementation. Mm-hmm. But then the scale is the thing that interests me. Like, once something happens in Europe, it'll pretty much happen across Europe, and that will just be it. Whereas in the US, they might start earlier, but it takes them considerably longer to, because their population and as a result, their conventions tend to be much on a much broader spectrum than ours are. There's a kind of a much slower take up of these kind of wide scale changes, I guess. Okay. So, yeah.
Continuing with Pellegrin, and continuing with the fact that, you know, you're all very diversity conscious. What are your plans to increase the diversity within the company itself? What would you like to do?
So a thing that I've noticed over the last couple of years while I've been trying to increase the diversity of our writers, which is kind of one of the biggest issues that we have, is there is a massive, it's really a triangular kind of population at the moment. So there are an awful, awful lot of new people, newer writers, newer designers, who come from underrepresented groups. There are a lot of those, but the further up you go, the more senior, I guess, you get at any aspect of the industry, the rarer it is to find people that aren't white guys. And that's particularly true with game writing. Mm-hmm. So that's my big challenge, is a thing that I'm kind of constantly doing is trying to bring in new diverse writers. But the key thing that I would like to be doing better and like to be doing more of is developing new diverse writers, right? So it's not really enough. And, you know, I think that I'm really seeing at the moment a lot of people are doing, say, stretch goals for Kickstarters, or they've published games on itch, or, you know, they're doing these kind of little smaller kind of projects, but they're not tackling, you know, and again, a lot of them are working in the story game space, which is quite a different beast to the more trad the more trad side of things, just in terms of the sheer volume, you know, the size and scope of the more trad kind of RPGs that we tend to do. So a big challenge is that a lot of people are now getting these opportunities, say on Kickstarter stretch goals, or, you know, they're kind of being brought in to write these smaller things, but they're not then developing their writing. They're not moving on to the next stages, right? They're not advancing beyond like 500 words or 1,000 words as an add-on to somebody else's project. And I think that's a massive challenge, not just for us at Palgrain, but for the industry in general, is you know, keeping those people on track and developing them, you know, making sure that we keep our attrition rate as low as possible, that we try and keep those people in the industry where possible, and we help them, you know. I mean, again, I look at, you know, looking at our writers, looking at like Robin and Gar, Ken, and, you know, Kevin and people as well, and it's just, they're all white guys, but they've all been doing this for years, you know, and that's the thing. So I'm optimistic that in, you know, 10 years time, we'll have a lot more senior designers and writers who aren't white dudes. But there is a big piece of work needed to make that happen. And certainly we're always limited by our size and by our bandwidth, you know, by the amount that we can actually do while keeping our heads above the water financially and staying afloat. And there is only so, you know, mentoring somebody in that respect, mentoring somebody to that level takes a lot of time and a lot of hard work. And I haven't yet worked out how we at Palgrain can integrate that into our daily business. You know, I'm creating kind of new opportunities for diverse writers all the time. It's kind of, I always make sure that I have projects that are, you know, kind of manageable and accessible, but that also kind of allow people to really do their own little standalone piece. But that's not helping, you know, that's not taking people to the next stage. So.
Is it hard because your company is, I mean, there isn't, apart from Wizards, I don't think there's such a thing as a really large company in the RPG world anymore. Even Paizo is not that big. Is it a challenge because you're smaller, it's very difficult to actually cope with the extra work? Or is it a challenge because there is also a risk associated with it of backlash from people who are not keen on the idea of diversity?
It's just the timing, really. I mean, we've always kind of, you know, a lot of the work that we've done we haven't done in the public eye, particularly because I think we're always, Simon and I are always really conscious of how much more we could be doing. So we will never be like, look at what we've done here. You know, we just do our things and we put them out and we try behind the scenes to kind of put in structures that mean that make sure that we are increasing the overall diversity of the company and of the people who work for us. We have had people, you know, hassling us and trolling us online and stuff. When we put hashtag feminism on DriveThruRPG, we had a kind of a downloadable free sample of it, and people kept downloading it and rating it zero. And it was just like waves of people. So eventually we had to contact DriveThru and say, like, this feels like, this isn't just, you know, people not liking it. This is an actual sustained attack on this product. We have experienced that, but it doesn't, I mean, what we want to do is more important than the haters. So it is just, you know, we would be doing so much more if only we had more time. The risk of kind of drawing, you know, people, there will always be some people that hate on what you do, whatever you do, really. It's just a sad fact of the world. And if you let that get in your way, then you'd never take any risks or do any good. So
that's a fair point. Right. To start winding down, I'm just going to ask you one last thing, and it's to tell me what three things would you say to girls out there who are playing role-playing games, who would like to write their adventures, who would like to do their illustrations. What would be the three most important bits of advice that you would give them?
So the first thing that I always say to anyone who's interested in getting involved in the industry in a creative capacity, the first thing I would always say is have some kind of online portfolio, right? If you're a writer, have a blog where you're posting writing samples, you know, be active on social media. If you're an artist, have an online portfolio of your art. You know, you have to show people what you're doing. That's the most important thing. And you know, I think that once you've got that, I think attending conventions is a really great way of meeting people. And it's such, I mean, the thing about the RPG industry in particular is that it's such a small industry that once you've been in it for a couple of years, everyone knows everyone. And people will recommend people to other people, and you know, they'll kind of, you know, the industry, to generalize a bit, I find it quite supportive. I think that people will generally tend to help you out. So, you know, going to conventions, meeting people who work for companies that you're interested in, whose games you like, right? That's another thing as well, is that, you know, you do not go into it for the money. So if you do want to get involved, you're going to be doing it because it's something that you love. And so you have to find a company whose games you love or whose art you love, you know, like look at people who are doing things that are interesting to you, meet up with them at conventions, play their games, talk about their games online, you know, and you'll get kind of on their radar. And that's kind of one of, I think, the best paths to getting involved, to whatever extent. But going to conventions isn't possible for everyone. So another thing that I would recommend is following people on social media. Again, you know, follow all of the companies that you enjoy, follow their social media accounts, you know, kind of find the people who are working for those companies, follow those people as well to see what they're kind of talking about, and take part in conversations. You know, don't be kind of, you know, glued to their every word and replying to everything. But, you know, where you have something to say, you know, respond on those threads or on those posts, and, you know, just be part of the conversation that's happening about games, both on your own social media and your own blog or whatever, and on that of the companies that you're interested in. You know, a lot of companies are always looking for playtesters. Mm. So again, even if that's not particularly what you want to do with them, again, you're helping out the company, you're getting your name on their radar, you're kind of getting their attention effectively when you're helping out in this way. Running games for people at conventions, again, is always a really big thing. So all of those things kind of build your profile as a person who is interested in working in the industry. And then it's just kind of a matter of keeping an eye out for opportunities. You know, talk to other people, talk to other women. You know, there are a lot of kind of Facebook groups and Discord servers and Slack channels and things like that, that people can get involved with, or join up to. And, you know, if you just kind of talk to people, you know, approach people at a convention, say, hey, you know, I'm interested in getting involved in this, you know, am I missing any vital, you know, online discussion places that I should be in, or, you know, things like that. So, and I think as well, like, again, you know, kind of contacting people, you know, very respectfully, understanding that people are super busy, yeah, and that you are basically asking them for a favor. But, you know, there's no problem with contacting somebody and going, hey, look, I'm, you know, a writer, or I'm interested in getting involved in production. You know, I've seen your career and your career path is kind of similar to how I would like to develop my career path. You know, what steps did you take? You know, what advice do you have for somebody in my position? You know, again, like the same kind of things as you would do for any I mean, I guess it's a little bit different because it's a lot less about formal interviews and a lot more about, you know, more kind of networking and more talking to people and being in the right conversations.
Good.
You know, and it would be nice if that was not the case, but it really is. It really is. And that's kind of how it works because the industry is so small. So
yeah, good advice. That's great advice. Right. Okay. So now we can all chill. And I have just the last three questions of the evening for you, which are question number one. What is the best advice that no one has ever given you?
So do you mean like advice that I wish somebody had given me or,
whichever answer is good for you is a good answer.
So nobody, literally nobody would ever have advised me to do what I did in university, which was largely ignore my studies in favor of getting really involved with the role-playing society and, you know, getting involved in the committee on that, helping to run the convention, running the convention and being super active in that and just spending all of my time gaming and with gamers. So nobody would ever have given me that advice to do that.
Okay.
But I did it anyway. And it turns out it was totally the right thing to do.
Good. Okay, question number two. What's the best mistake that you would like to make again?
Best mistake that I've made. Oh, that's a really tough question. Best mistake that I've made that I'd like to make again.
It's a tough one.
It is a tough one, isn't it? Yeah. A lot of my mistakes have been like learning opportunities, and I'm glad that they happened, but I would never want them to happen again. Although I have to say, you know, and I instantly think of the Hawkins papers for the Dracula dossier when I think of that. But actually, it was really enjoyable to create all of the props and things. So even though it was a really big mistake, and I wouldn't want to do it again, and I'm certainly, you know, going to make sure that I never make that mistake again, I wouldn't terribly mind having to do it again. You know, and I keep finding myself like making a lot more kind of prop documents and doing a lot more paper craft and things like that since. So, I guess every cloud has a silver lining.
Listen, as somebody who actually has a product and as somebody who still treasures the limited edition Book Hounds of London, and as somebody
that is a nice package.
Well, I honestly believe that you people do by far the best limited editions ever. I don't care what Wizards of the Coast's limited editions of D&D books look like, and I have them. I don't care what Monte Cook's limited editions books look like. The ones that really have some true amazing thinking thrown into them, it's yours. I mean, hands down. I want you to make those mistakes. I mean, it's very expensive for my account, poor thing. Yeah. But I don't care. I want them. So keep making them, please. Thank you. Last question. Imagine that you have a time machine. And as you can imagine, you go back in time, because why not? And you meet your 10-year-old self. And you say to your 10-year-old self, do not do this. What is this?
Oh, wow. Oh my gosh, yeah. Can I be cheeky and do a double negative, right? And because there's only one thing that I really kind of, okay, that's not true. I mean, I don't want to say that. But I very deeply regret not learning to drive when I was a teenager. I very deeply regret that now. So I think that what I would say to my 10-year-old self is, look, when you become a teenager, you're going to think you don't need to learn to drive, right? And you don't, but you should, because it's so much easier to learn when you're a teenager than learning when you're much older. So don't not learn to drive, right?
Don't delay learning. Good.
Don't delay learning to drive. There you go. That's better. That's word grammatically accurate. Yeah. And then everything else, I would just kind of say, yeah. Like when I was 10, I would actually, I remember I was writing a novel, as you do. And I would have my kid sister kind of pose like with different, like I have this one photo of her where she's like got a folded up bit of cardboard and she's like supposed to be, you know, the protagonist of the novel, like eating a biscuit. So I would like, as I was writing, I would take photos, you know, that would be the illustrations for my novel. So yeah, I would kind of say that's not going to go anywhere, but you will stick with the books. So, you know, that's, you know, publishing feels like you're really, publishing is like the job that I never knew was the job I was supposed to be in.
Good. And you're good at it. So, hey, everybody wins.
I work hard. That's it.
Kat, thank you very much indeed for being with me today. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I promise you that it will not be another however many centuries it's been since the last time you were in the show.
Cool. Awesome. I'll hold you to that.
That was the show for today. I hope you have enjoyed it and given you a very clear picture as to who is behind Pelgrane, what they stand for, which I think is absolutely fantastic. And hopefully we'll have inspired you to take a look at their games and give them your support and your love. So thank you very much indeed for being there. If you haven't subscribed by now, please do so and leave me your comments, because I really love to hear what you have to say. But until the next time, thank you once again for being there, and I will talk to you very, very soon. Take care.